You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Hey, everyone. This is Mark Schaefer. Join me, Mitch Joel, Tom Webster, and so many others at this fall's Social Brand Forum in beautiful Iowa City, Iowa. Every person who attends will get a free copy of my new book, The Content Code. Learn more and register now at socialbrandforum.com. Can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Stephen Van Bellingham. Stephen is a thought leader on the transformation of customer relations and the future of marketing. He is an expert in inspiring companies to become true customer-centric organizations in this high-speed digital world. His talks inspire companies about the smart usage of technology and the customer relationship without forgetting the human side of business. His keynotes are mind stretchers for business leaders. A very energetic and pragmatic keynote speaker, Stephen shares his vision in speeches and workshops around the world. Stephen is a best-selling author of business books. His latest book is called When Digital Becomes Human. The books describe the need to digitize the customer relationship without forgetting the human aspect. Today's world not only needs a digital transformation, the human side of business is also in need of a makeover. His two previous books, The Conversation Manager and The Conversation Company, are award-winning bestsellers with more than 50,000 copies sold. Stephen, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, what's interesting is you talk about how customer relations specifically is such an important part of branding. And what do you think the disconnect is that we so often get between this 1,000-foot-up brand strategy and kind of the in-the-trenches customer experience?
Well, I think the brand strategy is often the theory, and I think the customer relationship is reality. And my feeling is that a lot of companies are focusing so hard on what they would like their brand to be and how aspirational it should be, that they often forget that it is really important to connect with customers. And if you spend too much time just looking at the internal part of your company, it's like turning your back to the customers because your eyes are facing the internal part of the company. And I think it would be nice if a lot of companies would really invest time, and I think time is the key investment here, is that they invest time in reaching out to their customers and making sure that almost everyone from the company is connected with customers. Even the top guys, there are ways today with digital technologies to connect them directly with customers. And I really believe that that is an extremely important value for a company to invest in and for a brand to invest in today.
You know, that's interesting, that direct connection. You know, I think about when I started out in marketing years and years ago, I, like many marketers, kind of had my head down in my office, in my area, you know, sitting in front of my screen, creating communications for customers, and I wasn't getting in front of them as much. And then, you know, I was working for a small entrepreneurial publishing company, and we had a pretty big trade show schedule, so we'd send people out and stand in booths and talk to educators. And we were short-staffed, so I ended up getting sent out. And it was a bit of a life-changing experience for me because I got to be right in front of the customers. And I could hear, I could try out, you know, copy and strategy that I would, you know, kind of churning out on my own in a vacuum right there in front of customers. It changed the way I worked, and I made that a new requirement for me to always try to get out there in front of the customers. But it's definitely an easy thing to miss.
It is. And I was at a company today, a B2B services company, and they have a pretty big brand here in Europe. But it's amazing how much time they spend on their internal structure. And I challenged the management and I said, why don't we look for the top 100 guys in your organization? And we give them a database with randomly selected 100 customers each. And they send them an email or they give them a call and they say, from now on, if there's something that is going on in our company, both positive or negative, I'm your key contact now. You can contact me day and night. These are my contact details and I'm here for you. And you know, it's from the CEO to a number of business unit directors. And most of them first thought that it was a good idea until they suddenly realized that they would have to talk directly with a customer. And that scares them like crazy. And I don't care if they do it or not, but just the fact that they think about it and that it scares them, that by itself is really, really interesting for a company to discover. And you know, if you figure out ways to change that, it changes the perception of your company. I had this other client in the financial industry here in Europe, and what they've done was really cool. They gave each employee a budget of like 100 euros, and each employee had to look for a gift to give to a client of 100 euros. And for the sales guys, it was pretty easy, and for the marketers, it was also pretty easy. But like for the IT people, it's a challenge to find a client that you can give a gift to. But then after a while, what happened was that they started to talk with each other, and that sometimes five of them said, okay, let's invest 500 euros together to make a nicer present for this client. And suddenly the entire company was looking for clients and to surprise clients. And it changed the mindset of that company that, you know, in this world of brand strategies and everything, that just a small thing changed the perception of that entire company. And I'm really a fan of those small little game-changing aspects in a company. I really like that.
Well, I think it's amazing when you do something that's so seemingly small and simple and, you know, can have a huge ripple effect across the other employees, across customer base at large. That's that's kind of amazing. You know, it's interesting though, because you talk about, you know, today's high speed digital world, and in thinking about that, you know, me kind of in my cubicle in the old days, you know, not necessarily around customers, but today there's not as much of an excuse because you may not see people face to face, but you can connect with them directly in a way that you never could before.
Yeah, true. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the paradoxes in today's world. And it's one of the key stories of my book, When Digital Becomes Human, that the paradox is that, like, in this, the more the world becomes digital, the more valuable those direct human connections become. And it's based on the old economic law of scarcity, that if something becomes scarce, it increases in value. And if you look at the relationship between a brand and its customers, the one thing that will become really scarce is the real human interaction. And because of that, it is increasing in value. And if you think about it, you know, in this digital world, everything is transparent. Everything has become predictable thanks to data and thanks to social media and review sites and everything. And just because of that, the value of an unexpected surprise is increasing because we hardly ever have that surprise. So the law of scarcity is really, really interesting for a brand to consider at this time. And the funny thing is that sometimes a lot of brands think that digital and the human part are fighting, or that predictability and the surprising factor are fighting with each other. I believe that they just reinforce each other. If you use the strengths of digital and you use the strengths of human parts of business, you can create this new form of customer centricity that we didn't have 5 years ago. And I completely agree, Nick, that, you know, the human part of business is of course, on the one side, pure human to human. There's nothing stronger than people that are connecting face to face. But on the other hand, we have these new technologies that we can use for that. We have social media, we have video, we have Skype, we have all these tools that make it so easy to connect with people in a human way, that it would be a pity not to use those technologies to increase the human part of your business as well.
It's interesting. You talk about this this idea that people have almost created this conflict between things digital and human, and mm-hmm. and that they're really quite complementary. But why is that so hard for us? Do we see? Because I think that's pretty common. Is it that we see digital as a means to automate and inhumanize or dehumanize things, mm-hmm. and that we kind of just maybe we're stereotyping what digital technology is as opposed to thinking of it as something that enhances relationships?
Yeah, I totally agree with that, you know, and it's funny because digital, if you look at the strengths of digital, on the one hand, it is automation, it is increasing efficiency, it is automating human work. But a lot of people are scared of that and they only see like the downside of it, that says, okay, if you have a robot that replaces the work of a human, and if you have a computer that replaces human work, someone is losing their job. But in fact, it's nothing new. If you go back a few hundred years, we had the Industrial Revolution. And back then, everyone was in blue-collar work, right? And then they invented machines that would take away that work. But that never happened. And on the contrary, economy boomed because of those technological innovations. Same thing happened when, you know, I think about 100 years ago, when women came to the labor market. In theory, for every woman that would come to the labor market, a man would lose his job, but it never happened because we had more energy, we had more intelligence, and we had more force. Because of that, economy grew. And I think we're in a third phase like that, that today we have digital that probably will indeed, it will take away some human jobs, but I don't see that as a disadvantage because we'll have a lot new jobs that we just don't know that they will be here 5 years from now. And I think the key challenge is to have the mental strength and the mental power to see jobs that aren't here yet. Maybe the best example of that is the app industry. You know, nine years ago, no one actually knew what an app would be or what it was. Or maybe we didn't even had heard the word yet. I don't know. But today, you have millions of people who are in the app industry. And we'll have more than that, and we'll have faster new things than ever before. So I think the problem is that most of the time we're into linear thinking, that we see something new and we only see what it replaces, but we don't see the new things coming yet. And I think that's a challenge. And I do believe that if you look at the strengths of digital, that it is in fact automation. And that we should do that as a company. I think the checklist of tomorrow to go to a customer is to be fast, easy, and fun. And I think digital can enhance that. But if you look at the human part, and if humans are good in those things that computers are not good at, then we can make a difference. If you just think about empathy, empathic thinking, empathic communication, think about passion for your job, think about creativity. Those three are typical human capabilities that at this point, maybe that will change 10 years from now, but in this moment, people are really better at that than computers are. And I think as a brand, it is important to know that those strengths of automation, digital, and humans are different. And that if we use the strengths of both, we can reach that point that I call the point where digital becomes human and have this unique new form of customer centricity that we didn't have 5 years ago.
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, you talked too about kind of are things digital automating human work? And on the human side of things, you know, I think there's this concern that, you know, social media, all of these other different tools are replacing human interactions. And I take exception to that because I think that it's really enhancing those relationships. We're able to talk with so many more people. I mean, I've only today physically been face-to-face with a few different people, but I have connected with people around the world, with old mm-hmm. friends, with business colleagues. And I mean, I think that the potential for what it's able to do is absolutely, I mean, I keep dancing around the title of your book, but it's absolutely when digital becomes human.
Mm-hmm. I think we're at the kid side of the pool right now. If you look at what's going to happen in digital and social media, I still think we're in the early days of it. And 10 years from now, we'll be in the deep end of the pool. And I think for brands, it's important to learn how to swim right now before you're in the deep end of the pool. I think if you wait too long and suddenly you wake up in the deep end of the pool, it's going to be really scary. today we can still put our feet on the ground, but maybe 5 or 10 years from now, we won't be able to do that. So we will need the capacity or the capabilities to swim in deep waters. And I think that's one of the core elements for a company to understand that, you know, today you need to make that investment to be successful 5 years from now. And today you need to have that double transformation, invest in digital and invest in the human part of business. I also see a lot of companies that just invest in the digital part of the business because they see the competition from companies like Amazon and stuff like that and Alibaba. But if you only invest in the digital transformation today, I'm afraid that a lot of companies will wake up 5 years from now in a cold, rational company. And I don't think the companies want that. I don't think the market wants that. But I think it's a clear danger that if you focus too much on digital alone, that you will be so disappointed. Because I also believe that at a certain point, for every industry, we will reach this point where digital becomes a hygiene factor, you know, that if you haven't done it right, you're probably going to be smaller or be out of business. But if you invested a lot of money and you've done it right, 5 years from now, you probably realize that it's a commodity and that the moment when digital becomes a commodity in your industry, well, then you need to consider what will be my key differentiator, because digital won't be the differentiator. It will just be the minimum necessity to stay in business. And the moment when digital becomes a commodity, for me, it's clear that at that point, the human interface, again, will be the key differentiator for most companies, like it was 10 years ago. And it's that double route that will define success, in my opinion.
Well, it's really that, you know, I keep thinking it's you know, kind of two extreme poles, but it's the complete digital side, the complete human side, kind of where we've been, where we're going. It's like finding that delicate balance between... you know, what that sweet spot is, where you can complement things human with everything that that connecting via digital does.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe for like 5% of the companies, it will be good and it will be enough to invest in digital. But I think that we come up with those, what I call digital superheroes, like Google and Facebook and Amazon, those kind of companies, they are so good in digital that it will always be an advantage for them, I think. And they need that human impact less. But that's only for, I think, 5% of the companies the case. 95% will lose from digital if they fight directly with Google or Amazon. So they need to add something to it, which is the human interface. Especially, I think, now it's a great opportunity to do that investment because, you know, the difference between online and offline is disappearing. One of my favorite quotes that I read recently from the guys from Google was the internet is about to disappear, is what they said. And it's all related with a higher connectivity, more Wi-Fi, the internet of things, that in a few years from now, everything and everyone will be connected. And at that point, you won't need to push a button anymore to go online. But online will be like the oxygen of the offline world. And the difference between the two will completely disappear, I think, in the next 3 to 5 years, if you read all the stuff that's coming to us. So as a traditional business or a traditional brand, I think the time is now to look for opportunities to live in this connected world. And one example that I really like is the future of customer service. That, you know, 5 years ago we had reactive customer service, that I have a problem with a company and I call them or I email them or I tweet them, and if they respond or solve the problem within 24 or 48 hours, everything was okay. In today's world, it's more real time. We want a reply instantly, or we want to have a self-service application or something. But I think 2 or 3 years from now, fast will not be fast enough. Real time will not be fast enough. And it will be the necessity to act faster than real time, that as a brand, you become proactive. I was talking with a company the other day that is investing in that is producing central heating systems. And for just normal houses. And these guys are developing a smart central heating system and the system will send me a text message a week before it breaks down. It will send like, hey, Steven, this is your central heating system and I'm not feeling well. I may die by the end of next week. And I checked the weather report for you and I can only recommend you to push OK now, that we can send someone to get me fixed before it's too cold in your house. And they're developing that right now. And you can talk with almost every product developer that I know. They are all building these proactive devices. And that's the trend that I see, is that we're still living in a reactive world, but it's becoming proactive. And those smart machines are an example of that. But also in healthcare, like for healthcare brands, you know, the reactive healthcare world is evolving towards a proactive one, where you don't wait until someone gets sick, but you cure them, or you prevent that they become sick at this in the near future. If you look at what Tesla is doing, the car actually calls the driver before there is an issue. And you hear those things more and more and more. KLM, as an airline, they have 10 people installed, and they call that team the team Sherlock, as from Sherlock Holmes. And they want to solve problems before a passenger discovers the problem. And it can be something small like a gate change, but it can also be something like you forgot your iPhone in the plane. At that point, they want you to give you the iPad or the iPhone back before you leave the airport, and they will trace you by beacon systems. And if you hear all these examples, Nick, then it's clear for me that the reactive world is approaching its end, and we're approaching this faster than real-time world where you don't have customer complaints anymore towards a brand, but where the brand anticipates to a problem, solves the problem before I, as a consumer, even notice that there is a problem. And I think that could be a wonderful opportunity for brands to rethink the way that they interact with customers. And because technology and connectivity will be so high, we will be able to do that in the next 3 years.
Sounds like we've waded into that deeper end of the pool that you were alluding to earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's getting closer every single day.
So when I think about, to get somewhat esoteric a bit, I think about these labels. You are one that writes about things digital. You know, I've got digital in the name of my company, blog, and everything else. Do we think, you know, to the point of the smart folks at Google saying that the internet is about to disappear, is there a point where we're going to go from talking about, I mean, because obviously it's kind of the sharp end of the spear that most of us that are writing, thinking, podcasting about this are talking about things social and digital. But is there a point at which we're going to be going from, we're talking about digital marketing, that's really just marketing. There's not even going to be this kind of false wall that we still have up, but it seems like that wall is becoming paper thin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. If you just look at technology, everything that is a guy that I follow on Twitter tweeted a great quote last week. He said, "Everything that isn't perfect yet, we call that technology." Once a wheel was technology, once fire was technology, once a chair or a table were technology, and the moment that technology becomes perfect, we don't call it technology anymore. Before that, it's just still in an experimental phase. And I think with digital marketing, we're still in this experimental phase. I think a lot of companies are still placing their first steps. I think if you look at content marketing, we still have a long way to go to increase the impact of that. I think a lot of companies are wasting a lot of money there. So until we got everything a little bit more figured out, we will still call it digital marketing, I think. But probably 5 to 7 years from now, it will... Maybe we'll use TV marketing at a certain moment when we exceptionally do something for TV. I don't know. And digital will become more the heart of it. And the more it becomes the heart of it, the less we need the word digital. And in society, we'll probably stop using the word digital. The moment that everything is digital, you just mention it when something is analog and not digital anymore. So I fully agree with that.
So speaking of, our industry's labels and buzzwords, you kind of touch on the idea of how, for all that we talk about this big data, how can we actually garner some human insights out of it?
Yeah, that's a very valuable question. In my book, I wrote a chapter about that, and I used a model that works towards big relevance. I think the moment, I don't know if it's the same in the US, but when a company in Europe goes to the press and they tell the press we're doing something with big data, consumers become very, very nervous because they don't care what a company does with their data. They don't want to hear what a company does with their data. They want to hear the relevance. I think that's something that Google does in a very smart way. I don't know if you can find articles or interviews with people from Google where they talk about what they do with data. I think I I wouldn't be surprised if it's a policy at Google that you don't talk about data in a public speaking event or in an interview. They just talk about big relevance. And the moment that you talk about relevance for a consumer, they don't care that much about privacy anymore. And I think it all begins with using data to better understand your consumer. And let's use it to find big wisdom. I think that's the first step. Because then you better understand what's going on in the market. You'll be able to help them better. And I think that's the second chapter, or the second step. How can you use data to create big help for your customers? How can we help them better in service, in communication, in everything that you do as a brand? And I think the top level of that model is big personalization. I think those are the three things that as a company you can do to create relevance for a customer. Understand them better with big wisdom, help them better through big help, and create something that is really fit on their personal needs. And that's big personalization. As marketeers, we all grew up with the quote, who doesn't think in segments is not thinking at all. I think if you think in segments today, you're not thinking at all, because the segment size, the ideal segment size is one today. Because none of us are the same. Something like segments is just something marketers invented because we didn't have the data to go to the ideal market size or segment size of NS1. And I think that's the key challenge in data, to stop thinking in averages, but just thinking in individuals that have a specific need. And if you figure out that need, you will be able to add relevance to them. And when you add relevance, they don't talk about privacy. They don't worry about what you do with their data. They're just happy with the fantastic service. I think if you look at what's going on in Disney World with their My Magic Plus program, you know, the program where if you go to Disney World in Orlando, you get the magic band, the wearable, the bracelet that is opening up your hotel room, gives you entrance to the park, allows you to pay, make ride reservations, everything, you know. I think, by the way, if you want to feel what the future will be like 5 years from now in terms of convenience and by the usage of data and smart technologies, you need to go to Disney World as soon as possible. But what they do is, in a very smart way, optimize the experience for customers. They help them to have a better experience. They make it as personal as possible. And they use their data to also create additional value. Like what they see now, all their guests have this wearable, this bracelet. They can almost see them move through the park on a heat map. And at a certain moment, they could see, okay, we have so many people moving towards the Space Mountain. The lines will be too long. Why not place a Mickey Mouse character on the corner of the streets towards Space Mountain, so people will slow down and will want to take a picture with Mickey Mouse, and that will reduce the waiting time for our guests. That's what they're doing with their data. Or at a certain moment, when you're waiting too long in line, imagine you've been in line for more than an hour, they can see that and they can say, okay, we're going to give Nick a free drink as soon as he gets out of his ride through his bracelet. And I've been to Disney World last year to check it out myself. And at that moment, I suddenly realized the whole privacy debate is like a non-issue. No one in Disney World was thinking about privacy. Everyone was enjoying the additional relevance and the top customer convenience that we had. And because of that, you don't care about privacy. And I think that is a perfect example for me on how a company created relevance by installing a system that is boosting their data and their knowledge in an incredible way.
Well, like you said, I think, you know, nobody wants to hear about big data, but I think as marketers, we kind of cart it out, and it's really something that belongs as a backstage part of the conversation. You know, people, you know, it's almost like a natural resource that we've discovered, but nobody really cares about it in its kind of raw form. You have to make something out of it for it to matter. I mean, I think it, worse than that, left alone, that's when people start having, like you said, those security concerns, that they start thinking about their privacy and, hey, what are you going to do with all that information that you have there?
Yeah, that's it. And we had an issue with a number of banks here in Europe that went to have an interview with a newspaper, and they said at a certain moment, okay, we're going to sell the data of our customers to give them personalized advertisements. And you know, it was like a riot. It was like a virtual riot against those banks because people said, okay, now they're going to sell our data. They're going to make money out of our data. But if you think it true, that's exactly what Google and Facebook are doing, but we don't realize it like that because they don't communicate it like that, and they just give us the value. And afterwards, we think, okay, the product was free, so we must be the product. But okay, I get something in return for that. And in fact, that bank wanted to do the same thing because they have a lot of valuable data for me as a customer. They can know if I pay too much for my energy bill, for instance. And if they would tell me, hey, Steven, if you switch now to this provider, you will save that much money a year, I think that would be a great value. In fact, I think it's a great idea that they launched, but they communicated in such a show-off way that marketeers wanted to show off how good they are because they're using big data that it became a total disaster. And because of that, they don't dare to move anymore with data. They are afraid of it. It's like a burned item in a lot of banks over here. But it's just the way that they communicated about it. That wasn't the smartest way to do it, if you ask me.
Yeah. So speaking of things across the pond, you obviously being in Europe, but familiar with things in the States, at least in Disney World, which is a big enough... It's a big enough part of the States. You understand the rest of it. What are some of the key differences that you've observed between these two very big global markets in the States and in Europe?
Well, I've been to Disney World, and I also organize several times a year tours to the Bay Area. So I take European executives and take them to Silicon Valley to see what all those big digital companies are doing. And well, one of the key differences, and this is not good for Europe, but one of the key differences is the ambition level. I have the feeling that the companies that I meet, and I'm probably biased in my selection of companies, but the companies that I meet in the West and the East Coast are so ambitious, and they own this capability of having the ambition to change the world somehow. And at the same time, make a lot of money and position that as a positive statement. I'm such a big fan of that. And I have the feeling that in Europe, we're losing that a bit. It's there are not that many companies that are really, really ambitious. And I think we need to fight back and to make sure that we have the same ambition level as you guys in the US, but also the same ambition as the guys in the East, because we're like in the middle right now, you know, and in the US, you guys are really ambitious. In the East, they're also really ambitious. And I think the most difficult part, and this is not an excuse, but a reality, the most difficult part in Europe is the lack of scale. We have the same amount of people, I think, the United States and the European Union. But the problem is that we have probably 15 or 16 languages and different governments and stuff like that. And because of that, it is pretty difficult to start a company, to have a startup, and launch it immediately in the complete European Union, because the translation costs, to name one, are often extremely expensive to deal with all markets. Because even though English is a very global language, a lot of consumers don't speak English in such a way that they would buy from a company if they don't get addressed in their natural tongue. I think that's the key challenge of us here in Europe. On the other hand, I think we have the capability to understand that markets are different, and that personalization and make it personal for each market is a necessity to be successful over here. And I think that's something that is really into our culture, that we understand, okay, someone from France and someone from Belgium and someone from Holland are totally different personalities, totally different buying habits. And because of that, we've always, I think, been good at personalizing services and adapting towards local cultures more, because we see that the importance of that. I think that's the strength that we have more in Europe than in the US at this point. So if you could combine that, I think that would be a fantastic company, to be honest.
It's interesting because it's almost as though kind of, you know, the challenge that you talked about of, you know, things, it almost sounds like being more heterogeneous in Europe is challenging because you know, more languages, different, you know, different groups as opposed to the East and the West. But when you talk about being better at adapting, it probably means that the ones that are able to break through are able to do so pretty profoundly with that experience of being able to adapt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And we have a number of lovely companies over here. And there are also exceptions on the emission level. I think if you look at Volvo, the car manufacturer from Scandinavia, mm-hmm. I really love their ambition. What they say is that they want to make sure that by 2020, no one dies anymore with a Volvo, nor on the inside of the car or on the outside of the car. That's their key ambition. You know, and Volvo has always been known for the most safe car in the world. And now they want to go put that to the extreme. And they said there's only one way to succeed. We have to make sure that humans don't touch the steering wheel anymore, and then we can succeed in our ambition. So we have 4 more years before Volvo is completely driverless to avoid any casualties with a Volvo. And I love that kind of statement. Maybe they don't succeed, but the fact that they just make that statement, I love that. That's a fantastic ambition. Yeah,
well, it makes me hearken back to to President Kennedy and then the moonshot, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Because
you could have probably said the same thing about that statement, that, boy, mm-hmm. that's bold, boy, that's exciting. It might not work, but I think that's a great example of leadership and also communications, because it's specific. And, yeah. You know, I'm sure there's all sorts of other meaningful but perhaps somewhat boring metrics that you could use. But if you tell a story about no one dying behind the wheel or near a Volvo, mm-hmm. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. That's a great ambition. I think if more companies would have the boldness to say things like that, I think we would see a huge positive evolution in the world, not just for brands, but for the world by itself.
So you talk about bold messaging and more of that. You know, mm-hmm. you provide a lot of inspirational content to executives and business leaders. Mm-hmm. In so doing, what do you think are some of the biggest needs among leadership today?
Yeah. I wrote a chapter in my book, and I called it Heartketing instead of Marketing. And to inspire people to do marketing to the heart instead of marketing to the brain. And I think that's the crucial role for leadership. And if to come back to those two dimensions of my book, the digital one and the human part, in the end, you know, I think that the digital one is the easy one, because you can buy that, you can outsource that, you can program that. So once you've done it, it's done, and you just need good partners to keep it going. But I think the human part is the real difficult one. I think a lot of companies overestimate their human power. I think a lot of companies overestimate their human touch. They believe that because they work with humans that they're good at human skills, and that's not always the case. So it's my belief that the key challenge of leaders is to create a culture in which people can excel in the human part of business, and where their employees can excel in touching the heart of customers. I think if you can achieve that as a leader today, I think that that's priceless if you can do that. And, you know, those human skills that I mentioned in a bit earlier, empathy, passion, creativity, it sounds so easy if you hear it, empathy, passion, creativity. But the real question that leaders should ask themselves is, are we motivating our people to be good at this, or are we holding people back in these skills? And the sad thing is, you meet a lot of brand leaders and business leaders who want to be customer-centric, but when one of their employees or team members is excelling in, let's say, creativity, they get feedback that says, do you know how expensive that is, what you just did? And what if another client asks you the same thing tomorrow? Will you be able to do that again? So sometimes without really knowing it, we're holding people back from being good in the human interface, whereas it will be the key differentiator the moment when digital becomes a commodity in your industry. So for me, the key challenge for leaders is not the digital transformation. I think that's the easy part. I think the key challenge for leaders is to motivate their team leaders and to create a context in which people can really excel in the human skills and the human interface.
Boy, you hit the nail on the head there. And I think if anything makes a case for this book, it's that point that you said, that between the two things, digital and human, I think most of us probably have the problem, or at least our assessment of how we would deal with the problem, backwards. We think the digital piece is the hard piece, and we know people when it's absolutely what you said, that the digital stuff is easy, learnable, outsourceable. The human piece is very big, very sprawling, and you have some big cultural work to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, exactly. I think that's a crucial point to spend some time on in the next board meeting for a lot of people who are listening to this podcast.
Absolutely. Well, as we start to wrap up, Stephen, what brand in all the ones that you think about, spend time studying, has made you smile lately?
That's a good. That's a really nice question to end with. Can I mention a European brand here?
Nick? Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let me talk about Cool Blue. Cool Blue is a company from Holland, and they are actually the biggest privately owned e-commerce store in the world at this moment. They're pretty big, even though they're only active in two markets, in Belgium and Holland. They do $500 million in turnover and are very profitable. But they are one of the companies that are so obsessed with the client that it has become their marketing. But they're also extremely, extremely funny. And recently there was this guy on Twitter, and he posted a picture of a new pair of jeans that he just bought. And he tweeted to KLM, you know, the Dutch airline, and yeah. Cool Blue. And both have a blue logo. So the guy tweeted, "Hey, Cool Blue, hey, KLM, I have a new pair of jeans, but is this KLM blue or Cool Blue blue?" That was his question. And both KLM and Cool Blue are fantastic on social media. And KLM said, "Hey, yeah, it's definitely KLM blue." The guys from Cool Blue said, "Of course, no, this is definitely Cool Blue blue." And what the guys from Cool Blue did, they looked who that guy was. They looked for his address because it was a client of theirs. And they put two employees in a car, drove over to the guy's house, took a box with the Cool Blue logo on it into the house, and they placed that on the jeans, took a picture of that. And from the house of that client, they tweeted to KLM and said, "Hey, KLM, we're already in the house of that client, and it's definitely our blue." And I thought that was just extremely funny to see how they invested some time and some employees just for that online joke. But then you see the impact of that again. That was in the newspaper the other day. That was on the radio shows. People talked about that. And the real cool thing was that from the day after that, you could buy that pair of jeans in the e-commerce store of Cool Blue in the fan shop, so that everyone could buy the same pair of jeans. And they sold a number of them to other people. And that's, you know, it shows it tells you something about the culture of a company if you do those small, funny things. And the slogan of Cool Blue is, "We do everything for a smile." And that day, they gave me a smile, and I'm a big fan of that company. Not just for that, but also for their entire philosophy. It's one of those companies that is really good in the digital part and in the human part as well. They have one of the best YouTube channels in Europe, and they just make videos of their own employees who explain the differences between an iPhone 6 and a Samsung Galaxy, or how to replace a SIM card in an iPhone. And they post like 50 to 100 videos a week on their YouTube channel with their own employees, and they're spoken in Dutch, and they're pretty normal and boring. There's nothing special. But last year, they reached out to more than 20 million people with those videos. So it's a really impressive company to look at. It's probably my favorite company here in Europe. And they are the ones that gave me a smile the other day.
Awesome. Well, Stephen, where can folks go to learn more about you?
Well, you can go to my website. It's Stephen Van Belgem. We'll have to spell that. So Stephen is easy with a V. VanBelleghem.com. That's the name of my website. It's my name. You can go to my YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/myname. SlideShare. I have a lot of presentations online. SlideShare.net/myname. And on Twitter, I'm at StephenVBE. And I tweet a lot of articles and content and stuff. So you can find me pretty easily online, I think.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that. Stephen, thanks for being on brand with us. Before we go, I want to flip the microphone around to our listeners. Recently, our friend Melanie Deerdorf gave us a shout on Twitter about our recent episode featuring Mark W. Schaefer. She called it great drive time edutainment. That's exactly what we're going for here, Melanie. Thanks for listening. And if you heard something that you liked on this episode or another, be sure to tweet at us using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. Last but not least, you can find links to everything that Stephen and I talked about over at branddrivendigital.com. You can also find information for how to subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, if it makes you smile, head over to iTunes and click that star button to rate the show. And also, if you have a few extra seconds, write that couple of sentences and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. And don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by the industry-leading Social Brand Forum. You can learn more and register now at socialbrandforum.com. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.